All right, everyone. Let's see. It's Monday. It's November 4th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. I've already had the worst morning you could possibly imagine, although it's a beautiful day out there. I have to give the weather report. I do have to tell you there was water pouring into my basement, so I had to call the plumber. And then after I went down with the plumber to, like, deal with the water pouring into the basement, I went down to, like, sponge floor the floor, and then I went up and I cracked my head on a pipe, and I think I probably have a concussion. So I'm like thinking, oh, this is good. And, of course, I have guests, Ken.
Yeah.
So they can't flush the toilet. They can't take a shower. And I'm thinking, do I give them like a little ticket to the Holiday Inn? I'm trying to figure out what to do. Oh,
and when
God.
They ask you to help them and you sort of look at them with this concussed, crazy look.
And I say, I think I'm going to lay down and put more ice on my head. So if I start losing it, I told the gentlemen that are sitting here that they're going to have to take it away. And I'm just going to sort of sit there and go, Anyway, so tell me what's going on in your world. And then we will bring in a really interesting panel of guests.
Well, you know, I was at the J Street Conference in Washington, D.C. last week, the pro-Israel, pro-peace, pro-two-state solution group.
Right. And pro-democracy, the way we used to remember it.
Pro-democracy,
it
as in
right
democracy
now.
For everyone, not
exactly.
just for people of one religion, yes. Mm-hmm. And I told you a little bit about it, but I've seen several articles now that make J Street kind of the news, because J Street is now actively promulgating the idea that American politicians should talk about the occupation, should use the word and not be afraid of it, should acknowledge that indeed the Israeli military is occupying the West Bank of Palestine, and that the Israeli military in that occupation is controlling the everyday lives of Palestinian people. And not just talk about that there is an occupation, which Israel denies, and talking about American policy should be to end the occupation, but also starting for the first time to have a dialogue about whether the United States should make it a piece of leverage, not a condition, but a piece of leverage of American aid to Israel to have them improve their human rights policies and maybe stop the occupation.
Stephen Pimper is here, so I want to make sure that I get him into the conversation, because we're going to rethink the week, and I see him leaning in as you're talking about it. So I know that you're engaging his mind as well as his body, because he's like, okay. But you know what's interesting about what you just said about telling that the J Street is now suggesting to politicians actually to use the term occupation and talk about it? The reason I think they have to do this is that my despair with the Republicans is the way they choose to ignore the behavior of Donald Trump. And they choose to ignore the behavior of policies and processes that we believe in, and fail to recognize mistakes that are being made by this president. And I am distraught by that. And I think what J Street is looking at, what's going on in Israel, and they too are distraught by what they're seeing. And by not talking about it, and by not acknowledging it, and by not giving people a license to see it and say it. Let me repeat this. See it and say it. Then guess what? They are being compromised in their values. And the way I am so angry at the Republicans, because I see them as being incredibly compromised, I am really glad that J Street is doing this, because they're role modeling for, frankly, Republicans to say, look at this president and recognize that this is a behavior that doesn't fit into any kind of, you know, spectrum of democratic institutions, of an elected official, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you that the way America has looked at Israeli violations is similar to Donald Trump not worrying about the law. But also, and importantly, just regarding Israel and America, the Republicans are now taking the position, following their great leader Donald Trump, they're taking the position that anybody who says Israel may do something wrong, the Israeli government that's currently in power is making decisions that I don't necessarily agree with, that violates human rights, you're anti-Semitic if you say that. I mean, it started with Ilhan Omar because she conveniently wears a hijab. But the fact is that they are now saying that about all Democrats. Anybody who raises questions about sending a blank check to Israel, here's $38 billion. Go do whatever you want. No questions asked. That's what we've done. That's what Obama did. And now the question is whether we're going to actually use the leverage of our $38 billion to say, hey, look, guys, we care about Israel. We want democracy and a Jewish state in Israel, and we want to give you defensive support. But don't use it to weaponize the West Bank and send your soldiers in and randomly search people's houses. And I have to tell you, Arnie, one other thing, by the way, which Stephen might find surprising. At the conference, J Street Conference, five presidential candidates were there, and they were interviewed on the stage.
Yep.
And most of them agreed – well, they certainly agreed that there was an occupation.
Right.
And that not calling it an occupation doesn't make the occupation not exist.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Just putting your head in the sand is not going to make facts change. But they also were, most of them, willing to consider – using our foreign aid, like
so
we do with all the other countries.
All right, so who are the five? Who are the five?
Ask them to be more in favor, more human rights.
So Ken, who are the five?
Well, Pete Buttigieg was actually quite strong, to my great surprise. He was very strongly in favor of
using
stopping
leverage.
The occupation,
yep.
And in at least considering using our largesse, our foreign
mm-hmm,
aid.
Mm-hmm. Who
to
is the weakest?
Leverage. Amy Klobuchar was there, and Julian Castro. And they were pretty similar. Michael Bennett was definitely not.
Yeah, and didn't Bernie speak?
And Klobuchar was a little less strong.
Yeah.
And then Bernie came out. Bernie was the last one. And let me tell you, Bernie was just out there. He was on a toot. He was like Jeremy Ben-Ami with Bernie steroids.
All right. Well, at some point, we're going to grab our guest from Iowa because I can just see he just called in for our Rethink the Week.
I
want Stephen to be able to weigh in. But, you know, as I look at this, Stephen, at some point in time, I want to sit down with Israelis. I want to sit down with J Street. I want to sit down with AIPAC. I want to sit down with Republicans. And I want them to write a list. What is right and what is wrong? Define right and define wrong. I am so out of my mind because and there may not be consensus on right and wrong, but at some point I want someone to be challenged in an abstract way. What is right to you and what is wrong to you? Because I really feel like we have lost that ability to distinguish between them anymore. And as a result, it sets it up for the BBs and the Donald Trumps because we haven't forced them to acknowledge that there is a right and wrong. And it isn't just about the moment, but there are certain fundamentals, Stephen.
I am sympathetic. I feel that lament very much, as you do, but maybe I'm having a cynical day. But I feel like we do not live in a moment in either national or global political time in which that is a question that is going to get us anywhere. I mean, in some ways, right, this is sort of the question that keeps perennially being asked about Republicans and the president, right? What will be the line? What is the thing that he can do? What is the betrayal that he can engage in that will finally cause them to think morally and about the interests of the nation over interests of party. Yeah. And I think in some ways that is just a nonsensical question, unfortunately.
Yeah. Right.
There is no such thing. There is no line. There is no space right now for that kind of conversation about values.
So they're right now, at least for the base and for the Republicans that are so fear the base, there is this blind, unquestioning allegiance. And I'm just – you know what I'm shocked by? That there are so many of them. It's not that there hasn't always been a group of people that sort of have moved in that direction, but I'm just so shocked. So let me introduce what's going on here. We're waiting for Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He should show up in about 2 minutes. In studio, however, is Professor Stephen Pimpare. He is a nationally recognized expert on poverty, homelessness, and U.S. social policy. He is currently at UNH, and he also is a faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. So I want to welcome him to the program. He has been a fairly regular with us, so thank you so much for coming, Stephen.
Good to be here as ever.
And also joining us for the first time in this format is someone that I met and was recommended by a good friend of mine. So I have been doing Iowa politics and Iowa public radio and Iowa everything for about 20-some-odd years. And I started out because I backed into it with a professor from Iowa State named Stefan Schmidt. And then as a result of that, I was doing Iowa public radio for a while, and then they started flying me into Iowa, which was just incredible. And I got to meet the best group of activists and thinkers and policy people. So as we were going into this caucus, and there are so many candidates, and I realized it was really kind of a very complex board in front of me, I needed to talk to someone who was on the ground. And joining us is one of those individuals who's on the ground in Iowa. He is an organizer. His name is Sean Sebastian. He is the Iowa Organizing Director of the Working Families Party and Movement Politics Organizer for an incredible group called Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. Before that, he was the director of the Fed Up campaign at the Center for Popular Democracy, and he organized working class people of color to demand full employment monetary policy at the Federal Reserve. Anyway, his list of engagements on so many different levels, on so many different, you know, continents is incredible. And also because this was such an important weekend for the candidates in Iowa, because this was the big, huge dinner in Iowa, and I believe 16 of them are at least that number, were showing up. So, Sean Sebastian, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Arnie. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure. And Dean Spiliotis, our civic scholar and presidential scholar, has just shown up. So, Sean, I'm going to set the stage with you because you pulled the short straw in part because you're from Iowa and because it was such an important weekend in Iowa this weekend. So walk me through What are Iowa Democratic politics like? I mean, Iowa used to be a sort of a reasonably blue to purple state, and now it feels a little more like a reddish state. And I'm just trying to figure out what changed in Iowa, or have the Democrats in Iowa become a little more progressive and liberal, and as a result, maybe they've lost this sort of connection to the Iowa farmers and to folks in Iowa. Because I just feel like I could always rely on Iowa to be kind of bluish, and yet now I keep thinking, maybe not. So tell me a little bit about the lay of the land and what you saw happening this weekend with all those presidential candidates trying to sort of strut their stuff and stick out.
Yeah, so I think when trying to understand the landscape of Iowa, it's important to have a historical perspective that isn't just a snapshot of the last couple months, right?
Right.
So in 2008, Obama not only kind of surprised everyone and won the Iowa caucuses,
exactly.
He won the state in the general by almost 10 points.
Wow.
And then obviously everyone kind of was shocked in 2016 when Trump won Iowa by almost 10 points as well for like a massive, massive swing. And in fact, the highest number of Obama to Trump counties in the whole country are in Iowa. But that doesn't mean that Iowa's forever lost to being a red state, because in 2018, we had four competitive congressional elections, and when you add up all the voters in those four congressional elections, more people voted Democrat than Republican. So
okay.
That portends something really good for Iowa upcoming in 2020. So it's not irrevocably lost, but I think it's really important, again, to take a longer view about the underlying economic conditions in Iowa. So like the rest of the country, Iowa has had 40 years of stagnant wages, right? But different than the rest of the country is that Iowa's wages, despite having the second lowest unemployment rate in the whole country, are lower than the rest of the country.
Oh.
And they're lower even than the rest of the Midwest. And I think, like, when you think about these, like, massive swings, you have to think about, like, our dominant industry, which is agriculture, and what has happened over a decades-long period, right? So we had the farm crisis in the 1980s, and 85% of people who were farming back then are no longer farming today. We've had massive amounts of corporate concentration that has, you know, shut farmers out, that have driven them to the brink of suicide, and guess what? The administration that kind of like pushed these farmers into the globalized markets that have put their livelihoods at stake was the Clinton administration,
right,
with NAFTA and Freedom to Farm. So, you know, there is a lot of swinginess happening right now, and really it's not about, I don't see it as about like right versus left. I see it as top versus bottom, and people kind of looking for who's going to be looking out for farmers and the working class, because really these are problems that have existed for decades, and what we need is big structural change to address those problems.
Wow. Thank you for that education, Sean. That was really, really helpful, but also reminding us about Clinton and reminding us about the low unemployment and yet the lowest wages in the country. So there is no longer this nexus between low unemployment and increased wages, especially in a place like Iowa, which is so important. So, Dean, I have an article that I had pulled up, and I actually posted on Facebook because I was just so upset. And the article, the headline was, nearly 40% of 2019 farm income will come from federal aid and insurance. Oh, my God. The Agricultural Department projects that farm incomes will reach $88 billion in 2019, but 40% of that, $33 billion, will come from trade aid, disaster assistance, the farm bill, and insurance indemnities. And, of course, why does this matter is really what the question is. And as you just heard from Sean, it's a very swingy state, Iowa. And yet I'm kind of curious as to whether is that a solution for any of these Iowa farmers that 40% of their aid is not coming from actually growing anything, but in fact really being like sucking on the welfare teat or the insurance teat? And anything that Donald Trump has done, I don't see as improving other than he continues to write checks to them. And that can't go on indefinitely.
It's gone on for a long time. It's really been the short-term stopgap approach that presidents have used for decades to deal with the challenge of the agricultural market, of trade variability. I think Sean talking about structural change, and I think the fact that we're still talking about structural change gives you a sense of how difficult it is that to accomplish. And we're already seeing just over the last few days or so, the fissures within the Democratic primary field over, structural change. How big should it be? What kind of price tag is realistic?
Right.
How do you fund it? It's mainly in the context of healthcare, but my guess is we'll move on to talk about education. Elizabeth Warren in her proposal to fund this talked about slashing defense spending. That's going to be another debate that they're going to have. Structural change is tough. And, the agriculture industry is consolidating. A lot of small farms, we all know, just here in New Hampshire, certainly with dairy.
It's way down from
what it was, once was. And in absence of anything, this has been kind of the standard lifeline. It's just these subsidies and aid packages, et cetera.
Yeah, and I want to toss to Stevie because another little nugget from that article, and I just, in case the three of you didn't read it, was that farm aid from Trump's trade wars has cost more than double the 2009 auto bailout. I mean, again, we got to put these numbers into perspective. As you know, you hear the Republicans trashing the auto bailout, and then when you look at the actual numbers from what's happened as a result of the trade war, the numbers are astronomical. Stephen.
I mean, I go back to Sean's comment about 40 years worth of stagnation and decline, because I think that really is sort of an important piece of
it
the context.
Very important.
As we think about the primary in Iowa and elsewhere, and that picking up on something that Dean suggested, I think that while we spend a lot of time talking about how we live in this bifurcated polity with two sharply divided parties, the Democratic Party, and this has historically been true, is radically divided within itself, right? And I think it is fair to say that Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg are members of an entirely different political party than are Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah,
and in any other political system, they would in fact belong to entirely distinct political parties.
Yes.
And that I think, in my read anyway, is that a lot of what's happening within the party is precisely this debate. Is Trump a symptom of a larger problem, or is Trump the problem himself? And Biden and Buttigieg are arguing that Trump is the problem. We make Trump go away, everything is going to be fine. Warren and Sanders are making that larger argument about, no, we've got decades-long systemic troubles here.
What Biden and Buttigieg are saying is that's the first step, is to get rid of Trump. Then you can have a fuller debate over the nature of structural change, et cetera. The answer is not to shock people by going in a completely different direction from where Trump has gone, the opposite extreme, which is, $20, $30 trillion healthcare, Medicare for All program. So the debate is
– I want to bring Sean in.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
I agree with you.
Stephen's right. That's the debate.
So Sean, you just heard what I think is absolutely true. There is a lot of demarcation in the Democratic Party. And actually what I think it is that it's the Democratic Party as it was sort of historically envisioned, and that it was the moderate Republican Party. Well, the moderate Republican Party has died, Sean. And when it died, it became actually because of Bill Clinton with the New Democrats. Bill Clinton became the moderate Republican Party. And now we call them all Democrats as if it's a big tent Democratic Party. No, it's the Republican Party that basically there's a Republican Party like Donald Trump exhibits that chooses not to govern, that has told you that government is the problem, that chooses not to govern, that they want to blow everything up, and it's no to everything. No taxes, no government, no policy, no nothing. Moderate Republicans actually used to believe in governing. Well, now that moderate Republican Party is now part of the Democratic Party, and yet we keep trying to tell each other that, no, we're both Democrats, and I'm not quite sure where we are. But you got to see these guys over the weekend. Did you see that line of demarcation so bright while they were talking? And was the divide really between Buttigieg and Biden and Bernie and Elizabeth? Because my understanding is that Mayor Pete got the biggest applause line. Mayor Pete is growing in his support. And yet Mayor Pete, I know he's young, but are his ideas young?
Yeah, so these are great questions, and I just want to return to the question of subsidies before I dive into
that. Of course.
So, you know, these subsidies are a result of the fact that farmers have to put all of the take all of the risks. They buy the seed, they buy the other pesticides and implements, and then they hope and pray that climate change doesn't flood their fields, and then they put their product onto globalized markets where they earn a fraction of what it costs to produce. So this whole system is built so that big globalized corporations that that run factory farms can get feed at below the cost of production, right? So those subsidies that we're talking about that are going to farmers are actually a backdoor subsidy to these massive corporations. Wow. Now, Sanders and Warren, speaking of them, they have both a groundbreaking policy that guarantees farmers a fair price for their product, that takes into account how much it costs, and then guarantees them a price that they could that is above the cost of production. It's called parity. Mm-hmm. That would completely change the agricultural system, completely change the need for subsidies, and completely remove this backdoor subsidy to these corporate ag giants and put more money in the pockets of farmers, right? So thinking about Biden and Buttigieg...
Well, let me just stop you there. I want to just ask a question to the two gentlemen sitting here. They may not know. You know what this sounds like? This sounds a little bit, Dean, like the Dairy Compact.
Yes.
We had a dairy compact in New England that I'm not sure it even exists anymore. But that was the same. I think, Sean, I'm correct here. That was the same idea. The same idea wasn't about subsidies. It was about making sure that people actually got paid for the product that they developed, whether it was milk or whatever it was, and that it recognized it was a fair price and that it was focused on price and not on subsidies, which you point out so effectively turns out to be a backdoor way of making sure that the product is below market and isn't actually reflecting the cost of actually developing whatever the soy is or the milk is. Am I right about that, Sean? I think it sounds very much like
I mean, that's exactly right. And the contrast is especially stark with dairy because in Canada, they do have this price system. So you can see the complete difference in how many people are dairy farmers, how many people are making a living just across the border from you in New Hampshire, where the situation is completely different here. And what Warren and Sanders are saying is, like, let's actually get to the heart of the issue. What Biden and Buttigieg are saying, let's make America 2016 again. And for most of these, most farmers and most rural people, that's not good enough. You know, that's 2016 is a result of 40 years of disinvestment and deprivation. So I think, like, if we're actually wanting to win over rural people, we need to address the deep economic disinvestment that has happened over 40 years, and pretending that Biden and Buttigieg offer some moderate alternative that is more palatable is just kidding ourselves.
So let me go to Dean. So Dean, as I'm listening to this, I'm just wondering, then why did the farmers buy the trade war? If that's what they want, they don't want a trade war. They want to be paid for their product. And because of Clinton and because of NAFTA and all these international deals, they did develop relationships in order to sell their product on the large international markets. But why did the farmers, and why are some of them still willing to hold on to the idea of this trade war as a solution when it doesn't even answer any of the things you just heard Sean address? Not one, you know, and yet it seems like such an attractive answer, but it's not an answer to the problem they're currently having.
Well, I'm just two things just pop into my head. You know, the first is that it, you know, the trade war provides as kind of a focal point for, you know, figuring out why it is that you're not getting the price that you once got, or you're having to potentially sell the family farm after multiple generations. I mean, it's kind of natural to look for some sort of exogenous or external reason for the problems. The second thing is, and I think listening to you and Sean talk about the solutions of Sanders and Warren and how this makes sense. It may make sense economically. You may, on paper, be able to show farmers, rural individuals, that you know this is this these adjustments make sense economically.
But if you look at the data, part of the reason why rural folks and farmers voted for Donald Trump is cultural. It has to do with a whole set of issues dealing with, you know, kind of the perceived changes in society, bi-coastal, liberal, progressive politics, immigration, sexuality. I mean, there's a whole host of cultural issues that have resonated with some of these voters for a long time, which is why we often talk about them. People often say to me, well, why are they voting against their own economic self-interest? Because a lot of these other identity-based and culturally-based variables are very important to them, or it explains to them why they are where they are.
So let me just say something, Stephen, I'm going to toss to you, because what I keep thinking is, you know why the cultural issues work? Because they never saw anyone turn around and develop a policy that actually touched their lives. It's easy to say, I'm against abortion. It's easy to say, I'm against homosexuals. It's easy. It's black and white. But what they've been waiting for is a policy. And we just talked about Bill Clinton, what he did back how many years ago now? 1992 is when he first got elected. And we're talking about, it's like waiting for Godot, Stephen. They have been waiting for a government and a policy that would understand their lives and their challenges. It has never developed. So you know what? Bull crap to that. And therefore, embrace what you do know, which is easy, black and white. It's what my church is saying. I'm opposed to abortion. I understand that. I'm opposed to gay marriage. I understand
that.
It's very emotional.
It's identity.
Am I right?
It's emotional.
And regardless of which party has been in power, you know, we're not talking just about farmers in Iowa here, right? We're talking about large swaths of the American public.
Sure. Have seen, at best,
right? Their family well-being stable over the past of decades, and more of them are working harder and harder for less and less.
Yeah.
And it is useful, I think, particularly, right, when you're sitting around with a group of people who focus intently for the better part of their waking hours on politics, to remember that most Americans do not behave in that fashion. Most people are not thinking systematically and carefully about policy issues and engaging in a rational exercise in figuring out how that materially affects their own well-being. And particularly as we get into more and more sort of closed media communities,
right,
are dependent upon these very narrow conversations that tap into emotional appeals,
totally,
that give them an enemy, that give them a way to make sense of terrifying developments. And that's a much larger problem, right? How do you break through that and create spaces for people to engage in more thoughtful analysis with their community members about what could be done?
I'm going to have to end this part of the conversation. Sean, don't go anywhere. But let me just end with this. And actually, believe it or not, Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State is the one who sent me the article from the New York Times. And he said, this is so interesting. The title of the piece, everyone, and then we'll go to a break. 1 year from election, Trump trails Biden but leads Warren in battlegrounds. Signs that the president's advantage in the Electoral College has persisted or even increased since 2016. But this is the poll quote. And he pulls this out. Biden supporters are disproportionately male and working class. This group holds a variety of conservative views on cultural issues. 55% agree that discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against minorities. 79% agree that political correctness has gone too far. 54% would reduce legal immigration. God, it sounds like the GOP talking points. And on that note, this is Rethink the Week. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We're going to do a little labor history, and we will be back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1996. That was the day the United Steelworkers and Bridgestone Firestone finally reached a tentative settlement after a bitter 28-month dispute. After years of restructuring and decline, the company demanded massive concessions from the workforce. By July 1994, 4,000 members of the United Rubber Workers walked off the job at 5 plants across the country. They were on strike against wage and benefit cuts, the loss of holidays and union protections. They also rejected the company's attempt to institute a grueling 12-hour, 7-day work week and a 2-tier wage scale. The company permanently replaced more than half of the workforce 6 months into the strike. When the NLRB was slow to answer numerous unfair labor practice complaints, the United Rubber Workers called off the strike the following May. The company refused to reinstate hundreds of strikers, including two local presidents fired for union activity. Those who did return came came back to plants filled with scabs. Though the strike may have ended, a campaign for justice continued when the United Rubber Workers merged with the United Steelworkers. Historian Robert Weir notes that in launching its international campaign, the United Steelworkers publicized the company's pollution problems, its safety and health violations, and intolerable working conditions. It also forged an important link with a militant Japanese union, Zenroiko, raising fears that the strike could spread to Bridgeport's home operations. Protests, demonstrations, and boycotts continued throughout 1996 until the NLRB finally answered unfair labor practices brought against the company. The final settlement included the rehiring of all strikers, a wage increase, and all workers' original demands except one. Production speed-up would continue.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. To understand the influence of sports, look no further than fans' passion during last month's World Series. Sports teams have a massive platform, and Alan Hershkowitz believes they can use it to encourage a cultural shift on climate change.
Every day, in every city with a newspaper, there's a sports section. There's not a science section every day, but there is a sports section.
Hershkowitz is the environmental science advisor for the New York Yankees. He's long advised the team and others on sustainability, but his hiring early this year signaled the Yankees' desire to lead on the issue.
I am the only environmental science advisor in professional sports. I cannot tell you how influential it is.
In April, under his guidance, the Yankees signed the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework, a pledge to raise awareness and achieve climate goals. Other teams and leagues soon followed.
The NBA, they signed the climate pledge. The U.S. Tennis Association signed the pledge once the Yankees did. Wimbledon, Tennis Australia, Minnesota Wild. I mean, I could go on and on.
Hershkowitz hopes that as more teams get involved, so too do their fans. And that could be a win for the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
That's not what I want to hear, Joe, and I've got a right to know. Say it ain't so, Joe, please, say it ain't so. I'm sure they're telling us lies, Joe, please, tell us it ain't so. They told us that our hero has played his trump card. He doesn't know how to go on. We're clinging to his charm and determined smile.
All right, everyone, we are back. This is our Monday Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Say It Ain't So, Joe is by who?
It's Roger Daltrey.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's all in the words. Anyway, joining us right now in studio, we have Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. His blog is nhpoliticalcapital.com. You can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio for their version of Rethink the Week, but they do it on Friday. Joining us also in studio is Stephen Pimper. He is a professor at UNH. He is also a Carsey Institute for Public Policy a teaching fellow. He is an expert in areas of homelessness and U.S. social policy. And joining us from that great state of Iowa that gets to beat us to the punch when it comes to picking presidential candidates, but they do that. But they do that caucus thing. Sean Sebastian is the Iowa Organizing Director for the Working Families Party and Movement Politics Organizer for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. We were asking the question, so Sean, just refreshed my recollection, but are you originally from Iowa? Did you, like, fly into Iowa and land for the caucus, or are you from there and you returned?
Yeah, born and raised Ames, Iowa. I'm a graduate of Ames High School and University of Iowa.
I love it. Anyway, so as we were talking a little bit about Joe Biden, and in a lot of ways, that description I just gave you of the people that were supporting him, who you know believe that you know there's a real problem with racism against whites, and there's a real problem with immigration. It goes back to really the comment that you made, Stephen, which is that there really is a schism within the Democratic Party, and that schism is defined by you know Mayor Pete to some extent, and especially Joe Biden, and that descriptor of the supporters of Joe Biden, they feel very Republican, and yet for some reason they seem to sort of be able to create an identity and a relationship with that. So before we sort of get to the rest of the conversation, I got to ask this question, Sean, and then I'm going to toss it to the rest of the panel. So was the word impeachment brought up on the stage with the thousands that were in attendance and the conga line of candidates that were running? And if impeachment was brought up, in what manner was it discussed, or how quickly was it thrown away?
Okay, so Arnie, I'm going to just come clean here. These people come here all the time, and I'm not going to sit through another four-hour presentation of 20
It's like living in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I'm not going to sit through and kind of take meticulous notes of who mentioned what. But I want to say one note about you were talking about Biden's support, and I think this is something that all of us on this call need to grapple with, is that Iowa is a 91% white state,
yes,
and New Hampshire is a 94% white state.
Right.
And when it comes to these identity politics that are driving Biden and Buttigieg's support, and Buttigieg in particular, who is polling at 0% among black people, which is the base of the Democratic Party,
right,
it can really lead to some really, I think, warped outcomes in terms of our conversation.
Right.
So like that's really important to know, because a Democratic candidate cannot win without black support, but we forget that when we're caught up in the Iowa caucus circus and the New Hampshire primary circus because of the very unique and unrepresentative demographics of these two states. And I'll just say, when it comes to impeachment, of course, people in Iowa are tracking this, and what East Coast reporters always love to do is, no offense to New Hampshire folks, I'm talking about New Yorkers,
yeah,
they love to come to Iowa, they love to be at the Holiday Inn Express and then go to the nearest bar, talk to someone in a trucker hat and be like, do you care about impeachment? And then all of a sudden there's a trend piece about how no one cares about impeachment.
Right.
And that's just simply not true.
Right.
Like, people in Iowa are following politics extremely closely. They take this really seriously. And, of course, impeachment is on their mind.
So I want to go to you, Dean, because what's so interesting here is that Mayor Pete is tracking, like, 0 to 1% with African-Americans when it comes to their support. And maybe it's in part because they don't know him. As I heard one of the black congressmen say, for older blacks, the fact that he's gay is an issue for them because they are very evangelical to some extent. But what is so fascinating to me is, isn't that Biden's asset? I give you what Mayor Pete can't. I can straddle because I have huge support in South Carolina, which is a strong African-American demographic, and I have support in places like Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe not as strong as some others, but I'm still way up there, and therefore I can thread it. I can have a conversation with the white voter that feels like somehow they have been forgotten, and yet at the same time I have the support and the faith of the black voting base that they know that I also hear and get them. What candidate out there can actually thread those two populations in an effective way? And I actually see only Joe Biden, Dean, being able to do that.
Well, you know, the issue of the homogeneity of Iowa and New Hampshire, its whiteness, that's been a fundamental criticism of both contests for as long as I can remember, that it's not, but especially obviously among the Democratic Party, which has made a much more heterogeneous set of constituencies. And, you know, it's a legitimate concern. You know, Joe Biden, that really is his strength in South Africa. He's still very strong with African-American voters, particularly those over 50. And the other candidates are not. Bernie had trouble with African-American voters in 2016. I think Buttigieg and Warren combined are polling at about 13% among African Americans, and she's up from about 6 or 7%, but she's still low double digits. That's a concern. At some point, they have to figure out how to get past that. And now maybe, you know, if any of the other candidates do well in the first couple primaries, there'll be some sort of momentum effect that maybe will change people's perceptions. But at this point, you know, it really is kind of the Biden's hope that that is really the will be the great, great equalizer for him. We also have Nevada, which is in between South Carolina and New Hampshire, the caucus. It's a little bit of a wild card, a big Latino population, big union population because of all the Vegas, all the unions at work in Vegas and certainly in Reno as well. Those are the concerns, and it's an issue. How important of an issue you think it is varies. Different analysts kind of put different weight on how intractable of a problem that might be for Buttigieg and Warren. Buttigieg clearly knows it's an issue for him.
Oh yeah,
he talks about it. He acknowledges it. Warren, I'm not sure.
Well, Dean,
kind of what she's doing.
Arnie and I talked on this show a number of months ago when Elizabeth Warren went down to Texas, I believe it was, where
African
American Women's Conference.
Yeah, I mean you have to do those kinds of things. Sure.
But I mean, she did great. She wowed them. She really
she
won them over.
Yeah, but the question is it going to translate into support? It hasn't thus far in South Carolina. Maybe you said Texas. Maybe Texas will be a different story for her. But
at some point, more of that.
At some point, these other candidates, whoever it is, has to show an ability to pick up significant numbers of those voters. Now, maybe if at some point Joe is eliminated from the process, then they African Americans, Latinos, kind of rethink their choices and kind of redistribute their preferences. But you know, we're right now, and you know, things could change. It's still a few months, but we could have a situation in which Warren wins Iowa, Sanders wins New Hampshire, and Biden wins South Carolina, and then we go to Super Tuesday.
So I want to turn to you, Stephen, because what makes me crazy is that one of the things I hear, and you know, they're looking at, well, impeachment is a distraction. We're not going to be able to find any kind of bipartisan effort to work together because all it does is reinforce the divide between Republicans and Democrats. And obviously, this means that Congress will not be able to be effective in actually producing anything in the way of legislation. Let's talk about what they've produced. Okay. I mean, why do the Democrats not talk about the 230 or 260 bills that they've passed that are sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk? Why don't they talk about – I mean, it's almost like it's a fiction. The only things that have been successful have been the tax cuts, okay, that came through, and the other thing was the criminal reform bill. And of course, what's happened with the judges, which is a wet dream for the evangelical base. So you look at all these things, and I'm just trying to figure out what is it that will really be accomplished by this Congress that they keep saying this is a distraction from? Really, what will they do? Name three. You know, I mean, I can't think of anything at this point in time that they will actually come to Jesus on and actually pass.
Well, and I think that's important, right? Because there are I think, again, going back to these sort of larger sort of national problems, there is a tiny, barely perceptible space of where policymaking can occur across both parties right now. And the reality is right now in this wildly, I would argue, failed and completely dysfunctional Madisonian political system. Anytime we inhabit a space of divided government right now, there is no opportunity for national policymaking.
None.
And absent the kind of larger scale thinking, right, what that does for your space in the primary becomes a separate question. But I think that absent that kind of larger scale thinking about the systemic obstacles to dealing with the California is on fire, for example,
and he
right?
wants to pull
the aid. Sort of the sort of the scale and scope of the problems that we are confronting right now. The sort of everybody holding hands and getting together and having a beer in Washington in order to come to agreement is ignorant, naive, or just so cynical that it's an outright lie in the belief that that will appeal to voters.
Okay, so there was an article that was written about whether what Americans are looking for, Sean, is do they really want the revolution? We heard the revolution in 2016 with Bernie, and what you see now with Bernie and Elizabeth is a continuation of the revolution. I got a couple of questions, and I was just curious as to whether you might think of the answer. Bernie has never really been pushed about how he will pay for Medicare for all. But Elizabeth Warren has been bullied and yelled at, and she's incoherent, and the numbers don't match, and what about the billionaires, and do the math. She has borne all the weight of how do you pay for Medicare for all, and Bernie has completely walked away. Is it that people really don't think that he is ever going to be the nominee? Is it because he's not a Democrat? Is it because it's the same thing he's been saying for 40 years, so, you know, it's almost old hat with him? I'm just trying to figure out.
It's because he's a white guy.
Is it because he's a white guy? Why is Elizabeth the one that has to do the math and not Bernie? Can you explain that to me, Sean? Because I'm really confused.
Yeah, I'd love to, and this, really draws on my experience from my work on the Federal Reserve and monetary policy.
Oh,
but
good.
Before I dive in, I just want to say, going back to our previous conversation about South Carolina and the black vote, I'm just looking at polling from early November in 2007 and looking at how Hillary Clinton was leading Barack Obama in South Carolina by 20 points at this point. At this point in that cycle. So there's a lot of room, and I think like these early states really make a difference in how voters move in South Carolina.
Can I just jump in I hear that from people. The Clintons have had a completely different relationship with the African-American community than either Buttigieg or Sanders or Warren.
Right.
So they came in with a built-in – I mean, people often talked about
– She wasn't
about
white.
Bill
she
Clinton
was,
as being the first African-American
president.
Exactly.
Right.
Completely different.
Right, exactly.
It's not, not comparable.
But it's important to understand that the numbers don't necessarily reflect what
the
outcome is.
But to say that the Buttigieg and Warren will be fine because the Clintons were leading at one point, it's different.
Well, I think my point is the opposite because ultimately Obama won by 38-26. He beat Clinton.
Right.
So a lot of that support completely shifted. Like, so yes, Clinton
to an African-American candidate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So I'm just saying that things are movable. Even with an African-American candidate, he was behind by 20 points at this point and then ended up winning by over 10.
Right.
Now, when it comes to how do you pay for it, this is something that I think, like, you know, people are too smart to fall into this trap. Elizabeth Warren is too smart to fall into this trap. There's a lefty economist named Olivier Blanchard, who is the head of the IMF, right? This guy is not a lefty, and he is saying that the obsession with deficit spending and limiting government spending according to deficits has been completely debunked. We're seeing this in the conversations at the Federal Reserve, and the fact where they are also kind of completely, their map of how the economy works has completely shifted, because here's the fact. We just spent trillions of dollars on a upper-class tax cut and have gone more into the deficit than we have before, and the sky hasn't fallen, right? Like, the effect that we're worried about when we go into deficit spending is inflation, and we have had a problem getting up to target inflation. Inflation is actually too low, and we have spent trillions of dollars on wars of choice and on tax cuts for the rich, and the sky has not fallen. Now, imagine if we are actually spending money on the things that we need to do, like providing universal health care and addressing climate change. We don't need to be limited by these pay-fors. The scale of what we need to do does not need to be limited by the scale of what we can collect in taxes. That is a fact that is the economic consensus, not just of Bernie Sanders and lefty economists, but of the IMF and even people like Larry Summers and even people like Jason Furman now, who have shifted their positions in this post-crash period, because in the post-crash period, inflation has not gone up. So what we really need to do is break out of this trap about how to pay every penny of these major programs, because what we really need to be doing is controlling inflation. And so that doesn't mean that we can spend all the money that we want without paying for it. But the fact is, the limit of what we can spend is much higher than the limit of what we can tax.
So I'm going to toss to Steve, but I just one little quick nugget. I just saw this the other day. They were looking at the 2017 tax cuts, and we know that a lot of it was being used for buybacks. One of the rationales was going to be that it was going to be used for companies to sort of increase their investment in infrastructure and improve capital investment, and that it might somewhat also increase wages. We found out that in 2018, they actually decreased investment, companies did, in their infrastructure and in capital improvements. So the exact opposite happened. It didn't even change. It wasn't even level. It went down. We saw a massive buyback, you know, and we saw what happened. So in a lot of ways, I want billboards that say that. You know, not only do we have this enormous deficit, but none of the promises were delivered. In fact, the opposite happened. So, and what do we have to show for it? Niente, except growing inequality, Stephen.
I couldn't agree more that on our list of urgent problems, I can't find space on my list for deficits.
Right.
We do not inhabit that world right now. I do wonder, going back to Sean's point, if And to yours, Arnie, that if part of how it is that we have able to have radically accelerated deficits is precisely because so much of that deficit spending has not been investment, has not been productive. Right. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder, sort of right. thinking in very large macroeconomic right. terms, if we then turn the same quantity of deficit spending into productive spending, does the math change?
Exactly. So, Dean,
I would love to see how we deal with that problem. Right, I want to be clear. Yeah, I would love to be in that space.
Me too. You and me both. So, Dean, as I'm thinking about this, I saw an article the other day. I thought I really loved it. And they were talking about, you know, the Medicare for All and the trillions of dollars as if we're not spending the money now. Mm-hmm. And what this guy did, which I thought was so damn brilliant, was that he called private insurance a tax. Mm-hmm. He called private insurance a tax. What the hell do you think it is? When I write my check to the U.S. government, I write it out of my checkbook. When I write a check from my copay, when I write a check for my portion of my premium, when I write a check, what the hell is it? It is coming out of the same paycheck. We are doing it. When I lose a significant portion of my compensation package because my employer says, I'm sorry, I can't increase your wages because they just sent me a bill for 20% increase in your insurance costs, and you have a choice. Do you want to either see your insurance disappear or do you want me to pay for this? And I think that we somehow look at this, and I look at outcomes. Do I have health care? And then the question is, do I have to pay for it? Yes and yes. Now the question is, what happens with the kind of healthcare system we have now? Now the healthcare system we have now causes bankruptcy. It means I'm in network or out of network. It means when I lose my job, I have to go on COBRA or I go bareback without health insurance. Look at all the vulnerabilities that are resulted, even if I'm still writing the frickin' check. Yeah, but why can't we do this?
The problem is a couple things. This is really interesting comments. Oh, I mean, the first thing is, Democrats could certainly, and Democrats who support Medicare for all, could certainly make that argument that you're making about the idea of it being a tax. Right. I've heard the opposite. I've heard other Democrats say that, you know, Warren has made a mistake by shifting from a healthcare discussion to essentially turning this into a tax discussion because in the end it always devolves to that. The second thing is, you know, I was listening to you kind of talk about the questions that you might ask yourself about healthcare.
Right.
The problem is that's true for one group of people, the people who are currently underserved, but for another very large group of people who are probably more likely to vote, the question is, do I get to keep my doctors? Do I get to have the same kind of setup that I've had for some number of years? Maybe I would like to pay less, have a lower deductible, have lower copays, what have you. But I keep hearing, and I this is something that Warren and Sanders folks will have to figure out. I keep hearing union Democrats say, we didn't do all this negotiation to throw this stuff away for Medicare for All, that we like what we negotiated
for.
So there may be an answer to that. I don't know what it is at this point, but that's what they're going to have to contend with.
There's four people in this room, and then there's Sean. There's five.
Yeah.
Of the five, two of us are old. Okay, I'm one of them. Ken is the other. Yeah. And that is that
Eric? Nice. I get to be the young guy. How did I manage that?
That's okay. So let me just say something. I went on Medicare last year. I didn't sit around going, will I lose my doctor? Because I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't sit around going, first of all, I want people to know you can frighten people. And there's a really good, we frighten people with the Affordable Care Act. Now they don't want to let it go. Okay, let's remember that. They're so terrified of letting it go. You can frighten people, but I want to remind people, you were so afraid of the Affordable Care Act? Really? How bad was it for you? You know, and if you're and now there's still problems. Imagine what would happen if you got to do what I get to do at 65.
Also, on my private insurance company, there are lots of people, especially specialists, who are not in the network. And so I can't go to the people I want to go to. It's the private insurance companies have people you can't go to also.
Conveying that, as Arnie said, it scares people, and the problem is conveying that to people. And the Obama, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. We saw that kind of blew up on him at one point, and so that's the same argument cycling back around.
But it's because the Republicans are
fair argument or not, that's the argument.
Let me grab Sean, and then we'll turn to Stephen. Yes, Sean, quickly.
So a couple things on this. Like, one, I think this is a popular education problem.
Yes.
This is a messaging problem.
So when we talk about unions, most rank and file union members that I know are saying the exact opposite. Like, if we take healthcare off the bargaining table, that's leverage that we can take into wages. If we have universal healthcare, we don't have to give away the store on fighting for decent healthcare. And then the other thing is, like, my previous job, I was was part of a unionized staff. And guess what? My health care changed, right? Like, yes. Your health care changes, your access to doctors changes every time you switch jobs. And even when you're on the job, your employer can change the health care. So when it comes to stability, when it comes to access to doctors, Medicare for All is an improvement over every situation.
All right, Stephen, last comment.
The policy discussion is important. I think we also need to fold into it sort of the practical reality of how do we create spether, whether it's marginal changes to the ACA or Medicare for All, how do we envision a world in which there is political space for either of those to be enacted?
Well, and again, I am the kind of person, I'm a single-payer baby, but I am more of the person that reminds everyone over and over again. The Canadian system didn't happen overnight. It went province by province. The Germans have a model. It's not the single-payer model. The British have a model. It's not the same model. The French have a model. There's a lot of ways to come to God on this. And I would love to sit down with Bernie, frankly, and Elizabeth Warren and say, really? So are you really upset about how the Germans do it? They do it very well. Are you upset the way the Swiss do it? They do it very well. What they do is they do it better than us. And that's part of the problem is I'm not a purist, but I want a freaking outcome. And that's one of the reasons why I like what Elizabeth and Bernie do, is that they actually talk about a system that will be all-inclusive, which is what we ultimately want. But I'm going to say this right now. There are many paths to God, including Medicare for All. And on that note, I need to let you guys go. Rethink the Week has been so much fun. Dean Spiliotis, Stephen Pimpare, Sean Sebastian, Ken Barnes. I'm exhausted. What do we end with, Steve? Oh,
we end with what's happening tomorrow. We talked about today. What's happening tomorrow?
Absolutely perfect.
Duran Duran.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. I really appreciate it. Here we go.
Close. There are times we punish those who we need the most.